Las Vegas, Nevada, a city accustomed to high stakes, but tonight, the highest stakes of all.
Leadership of the free world. It's Tuesday Night Debates.
Will it be a Hillary Hail Mary, or is it time to burn, baby, burn?
Will Jim Webb take another life?
And what about the block of granite?
There's also another guy named something like Mayor McCheese.
At the end of the night, one debater will get a rose from Anderson Cooper.
I don't think that's exactly how it works.
We'll find out in minutes when these five debaters kick off.
It's no secret, these people don't like each other.
How big is this debate? Big.
It is so big.
We cannot communicate how big it is.
Now let's throw it down to our sideline reporter, Colin McEnroe, with lots of girl questions. And whether people have any boo-boos.
Yeah, just because I'm a sideline reporter doesn't mean I'm going to ask girl questions. That is such a stereotype. All right, so we did that a long time ago. We did that intro whenever it was that there were five Democratic candidates debating in Las Vegas. So go ahead, you Google that. But our point at the time was that an awful lot of things that aren't sports, things that might more accurately be placed in the category of public affairs or news, are treated increasingly like sports and packaged increasingly like sports. But we didn't think, well, first of all, let me say that we didn't think as deeply about it as our first guest did today. Let me also say that this is going to be a little bit of a theme here in the early part of the show about how, I mean, we've talked an awful lot about what is going on in this absolutely unprecedented kind of political climate and presidential administration, but maybe we've talked a little bit less about how people process it and categorize it and understand it. So we're going to focus on that a little bit in the first segment. And in the second segment, we'll kind of segue to a different kind of take on it. We have a writer for the National Review, Kevin Williamson, who's going to be talking about how you can understand the Trump administration through the play Glengarry Glen Ross and other products of that ilk that kind of articulate a kind of alpha male position. And then towards the end, because everybody is suddenly fascinated by chiefs of staff. Chiefs of staff are really interesting all of a sudden. I cover news and politics and whatever all that stuff is, hard news, I don't know. I happen to know that Barack Obama had four chiefs of staff. I could tell you the names of two of them. And I actually have to pay attention to this kind of stuff. But chiefs of staff are suddenly very in vogue, very interesting. Chris Whipple has a book out about the history of chiefs of staff. So that'll be our final segment today. But as I said, we're going to start with Brian Curtis. He is an editor at large at The Ringer. He's one of our favorite guests. And he has been writing about the sportsification of things that are not sports, and most specifically the debate and vote over the health care bill. So Brian Curtis, welcome back to our midst.
I'm ready for some football.
All right. Are you really ready for some football?
I am.
Some night it'll just consist of them asking that question over and over again until they really establish that everybody in America is ready for some football.
We need some answers.
And then they'll sign off. And then they'll sign off after that. So as you point out, the healthcare bill was not a trivial matter. This is people will probably live or die in some cases, depending on whether they can get access to decent healthcare, whether they can participate in preventive healthcare. So it's no laughing matter, and it's certainly no trivial matter, and it's probably a little bit more important than, say, an average NFC North, contest. So, but as you say, in some ways, there's some way in which our antennae for that kind of thing, for a sports event, were tuned towards something as important as the healthcare debate. I will now stop babbling and let you lay out your premise.
Well, it really reminded me of it on Thursday night because we have this, we all know what time the Super Bowl is, right? But there are these lesser sports events on the calendar that people sort of find out about on Twitter. They get on Twitter and a couple of people are watching, say, a pitcher on the West Coast throwing a no-hitter or some weirdly competitive Pac-12 football game between Utah and Oregon State where the score is like 61-62 in the fourth quarter. And then they all sort of get online, and everybody goes, ooh, what channel is that on? Who's playing? What's going on? What are the stakes here? Does this affect the playoff or something? And everybody gets online and starts tweeting about it. And that was, again, minus the life and death that you mentioned and the importance of the policy, that's basically what happened on Thursday night as the Senate voted on this so-called skinny health care repeal bill.
Right. And there are, as you explain, well, actually, before we get to that, I just want to say that even when I read your piece, I resonated right away because I had been thinking, and I'm older than you are, and I had been thinking, this reminds me of a very specific thing, the whole spectacle of John McCain, diagnosed with a very serious form of brain cancer, coming back to participate in this thing, reminds me of something from my adolescence, and this is what it is. And we
the Knicks come out to warm up. There's no Willis Reed. He's not there. And all of a sudden, a roar ensues.
Here comes Willis, and the crowd is going wild.
And you look over at the entrance to where the players come out, and there's Willis lumbering out on the floor, uniform on, appearing that he's going to play. And I got to tell you, that was unbelievable. That was unbelievable because of the incredible. I get chills actually thinking about it right now, a few years later.
So there's a grown man saying he gets chills. I remember Marv Albert saying, the Lakers are not even warming up. They're just watching Willis test that leg. And so, I mean, that's a trope, right, Brian? That's something that we're kind of familiar with.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the wounded, you know, sort of star coming out to do one last thing. I guess to complete the metaphor here, though, Willis would have had to score a couple of buckets for the Lakers, right? Sabotage his own team. That's essentially what John McCain did. And of course, that added to the drama of the night, right? We had no idea what McCain would do. And I think one of the weird sports parallels here is that with most Senate votes, most House votes, the outcome is preordained. People don't call these things without knowing the results. But here was one of the few times where we didn't know the results. We didn't know what was going to happen. Reporters are groping around trying to figure it out. And that, I think, added to the whole spectacle as well.
Right. My producer, Jonathan McNichol, also points out the, of course, famous Kirk Gibson home run, also kind of a similar
sure.
kind of thing. But as you point out, the person most in charge of us not knowing the outcome was McCain, right? McCain called attention to this. How did he do that?
Yeah, so reporters are asking him when he's striding purposefully to the Senate floor and saying, how are you going to vote, Senator? How are you going to vote? And his quote was, watch the show. Or in another rendering for the Washington Post, wait for the show, right? So he's the one telling us. This is not political reporters trivializing great matters of state or political reporters who secretly want to be sports writers, right? Mm. Ginning up the stakes here. This is the guy who could have released a press release, could have tweeted, could have done any number of things saying, you got to wait for it. You got to watch TV tonight, and everything will be revealed before your eyes.
As you also point out, I mean, there are one of the ways that we sometimes can be made to care about a thing that we don't just naturally default into caring about is through storyline. So, I mean, this is, of course, especially true in things like Olympic whitewater kayaking, where it's important for us to know, you know, about some promise that somebody made to his dying grandfather or something, because otherwise we're not going to watch Olympic whitewater kayaking. And as you point out, this everything that we just said is effectively a storyline, correct?
Yeah, and what I found is that the sports media, as I've gotten older, is just much, much more explicit about this. Before the game starts, the announcer or the sports writers literally say, here are the storylines. Not here are some things that would add to the drama of this night, but here are the storylines. And with McCain, we had some pretty clear ones. Obviously, he had been diagnosed with brain cancer the week before. He comes back to the Senate. He gives this stirring speech about the sanctity of Senate procedure, and this is what this body is, this deliberative body is about. But then he votes with the Republicans to help them evade such procedure and proceed to this climactic vote on Thursday night. So those were all the things that were going around in our head as we watched C-SPAN in the wee hours of the morning.
So, there are two ways in which, in sports, storylines reach us. Either they reach us through some, NBC sports staffer researching, the whitewater kayaking to find out if there's anything interesting about the people doing it, or when the athletes essentially proclaim to us that they are the storyline. I mean, think, I don't know, you probably have a better example than I do. I don't know, Deion Sanders or somebody, you know, just somebody who just basically believes that he is the storyline. This is what you need to know. I'm going to do, I'm going to be in charge here. And that's kind of what McCain did. And I wonder what you think about that, too, because, you know, those kinds of athletes, and as I say, you could probably come up with better examples than I can, often are not all that well liked by their teammates. And, you know, you sort of wonder about the Susan Collins and the Lisa Murkowskis, who were kind of there, you know, doing some of the initial blocking, you know, before McCain took the ball and ran through the hole for the touchdown, to complete my tortured sports metaphor. You know, I mean, nobody's really talking about them the way they talk about McCain, right? McCain made himself central to the story.
No, it's like Babe Ruth pointing to the fence right before he hits a home run, or Reggie Jackson saying, "I'm the straw that stirs the drink."
Yeah.
Hey, look at me. Here we go. This is all on my shoulders, baby. No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, people pointed out pretty quickly after, you know, when we were all kind of, you know, a gaga over McCain and what he had done, that, you know, here are two Republican senators who had risked an enormous amount of political capital to do this. And their votes count exactly the same as John McCain. But they didn't have the same taste for drama, and then they didn't say watch the show. It was pretty obvious what they were going to do. And so we didn't, you know, so they didn't in weird ways sort of attract the same kind of attention. But that is funny. You know, I think with athletes, we always say there's this criticism longstanding with sports writers. Look at me, athletes who bring attention to themselves rather than bring the lunch pail to work, right? But in a way, that's the stuff that drives sports writing. And that drives sports television. All sports writers might say they don't like people like that, but they secretly want people like that. Because those are the people that get put butts in the seats, that gets you to tune in, and that makes puts money in sports writers' pockets, right? Athletes that say, watch this, watch the show.
Right, and that becomes the story, and writers and broadcasters are looking for stories to tell. They're probably more interested in that kind of Reggie Jackson athlete than are maybe even average people sometimes, or certainly some of the colleagues of those kinds of look-at-me athletes. I also feel as though, disagree with me if you want, but I feel as though once the media gets its hooks into a certain kind of storyline, like McCain, wounded warrior, brain cancer, courageously coming back to cast this all-important vote, they stop asking questions about it, and they just basically play that thing out the way that it's supposed to be played out. I don't know. McCain's staff supposedly has said in the past that he's nine parts hero and one part troll. And the other way of understanding that night was he was just trolling the crap out of the Trump administration, who we know he hates for their terrible treatment of him. I mean, he had a meeting with Mike Pence. How likely was it that, you know, that he was open to some argument Mike Pence might be making at that moment? You know, he dragged it out to this final moment, I think partly to torture them. Although that doesn't really fit the Willis Reed narrative.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing about politics, you can be a troll and a hero at the same time. Mm. Because so much of what political writers like about John McCain is he's been trolling his own party. And I think it's funny you mentioned that, how we took this sort of news, this sort of idea and ran with it. It's totally true, because the week before, and really the months and months before, because John McCain endorsed Donald Trump in the election, even after all the stuff Donald Trump said about him in particular, even after the Access Hollywood tape, John McCain endorsed Donald Trump for president. And I think one thing is we'd had this kind of complicated conversation about John McCain. Is he really a maverick? What does that mean? Is this, if he had a quote-unquote mavericky period, is that long since done? And really, he's just a Republican now. And he's just, you know, this John McCain is really a pretty conventional Republican who sides with leadership most of the time. But as soon as this happened, I turned on CNN and someone said, is John McCain the new lion of the Senate? What does that mean? why did John McCain suddenly become a lion at that moment? You know, Teddy Kennedy was a lion. So what is you know, trolling your own party, as you put it? Does that make you? Does that you grow a mane at that point? I don't get it. But again, we had the ball in our hands, to use your tortured metaphor, and we're running in a broken field. It's all McCain as hero from there.
You know, Brian, the other thing that your piece got me thinking about, it's something that we've talked about on the show in the past, in the intro that you heard, sounds fanciful, but it's not. So this actually is CNN's intro for the all-important 2016 vice presidential debate. This is, we didn't produce this. This is their real intro from October 4th, 2016.
Tonight, the vice presidential candidates in a high-pressure test.
Hillary Clinton will never be elected president.
With a close election on the line.
Donald Trump wants us to trust him? Are you kidding me?
Senator Tim Kaine and Governor Mike Pence battling for the nation's second highest office and making the case for their campaigns.
When Donald Trump becomes president of the United States of America, the change will be huge.
Hillary is ready. She's ready to fight. And she is ready to lead.
This is CNN's coverage of Kaine versus
Well, I'm going to fade it. I mean, Brian, that's not even Monday Night Football. That's really more kind of like WWE, right? These on CNN, when it comes to this kind of production, they kind of are without shame. But all the networks do this, right? They make it sound like sports.
Well, and no offense to your staff, but that was way more absurdist than even the parody you put together. You couldn't have possibly topped that. So, yes, sports television and network news are the same aesthetic at this point in history. There is no difference. The interesting question to me is, what is the chicken and the egg of this? Because I think I am mostly a sports writer in my professional life, and I often hear people say, oh, CNN has become just like ESPN, you know, from the overdone intros to the panel of 19 people arguing about it. You know, it's just like everything has a pregame show, everything has a postgame show, everything has a countdown clock. But, you know, I seem to remember Crossfire being on CNN going way back into the early 80s and them having a really good sense of people arguing. So I think it's just a question of who's to blame. And I think parts of it we could pull from sports television and parts we could just pull from news. And here we are that they have become one great, weird, strange creature in our lives.
I actually have, for your inspection, Brian Curtis, that one great strange creature who has fused those two sensibilities perfectly. His name is Scaramucci.
But here's what I tell you about the president. He's the most competitive person I've ever met. Okay, I've seen this guy throw a dead spiral through a tire. I've seen him at Madison Square Garden with a top coat on. He's standing in the key and he's hitting foul shots and swishing them. Okay, he sinks 3-foot putts. I don't see this guy as a guy that's ever under siege. This is a very, very competitive person. Obviously, there's a lot of incoming that comes into the White House, but the president's a winner, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to do a lot of winning.
All right. So there you have it, Brian.
It's like five sports metaphors in a row, my favorite of which is you're inside a basketball stadium wearing a top coat.
Right.
Shooting the free throw. It's not just in a suit, right? It's just you have the top coat on. Why are you doing that? That's just a very, very funny image of success.
Yeah, I'm picturing the guy that Robert De Niro has to kill in the old neighborhood, Don Cheech, I think his name is, in The Godfather. You know, that kind of top coat, like a cape-like thing where he's shooting. But this is the fusion, right? That there's an insistence on the excellence of this person based not on his ability to be president, but on some kind of, I think, highly imaginary sports prowess.
Yeah, and he's converting everything to a binary world of winning and losing.
Right.
So that, you know, every act that happens in politics now is a W for Trump or an L for Trump. And, of course, he would insist probably everything was a W. And even the other night, you know, so this big climactic Senate vote ends, and we're all sitting there waiting because we're waiting for the Trump tweet. Like, that is the epilogue to everything now. It's, okay, something has happened, and now Trump is going to tweet about it. And, in fact, he gave this bizarre tweet about how he thought the Senate should not have the 60-vote filibuster-proof barrier, but the 50-vote barrier, which, of course, it was a 50-vote barrier in this particular instance. But that's Trump, right? And that's another staple of sports television, which is preview of next week's games, right? Trump is not just telling us what happened, but here's the next fight. Here's the next thing over the horizon so that we all stay tuned, as it were.
It's what they should do, actually, is, you know, and I guess they sort of do it, but what would be better would be to have Trump do sort of like a, you know, Mike McCarthy, Bill Parcells type thing after the vote where he has to go to the podium and just take a lot of questions, you know, about, like, you know, why didn't that work or, you know.
He'd like that, don't you? Or if not with questions, how about just like a Facebook Live, you know, Trump staring into a camera from his television where we can see the kind of the glow of Fox News or CNN on his face as he watches live with us. I mean, that's kind of a very 2017 media thing to do. I actually think he'd have some fun with it.
It's hard to come up with a punishment for Donald Trump that he won't like. All right, so I'll get in trouble with certain people if I don't point out that the White House, when they released the transcript of Scaramucci, changed 3-foot putts to 30-foot putts. But that's really true. They actually did do that. So I don't know what fit that into any kind of box you want to. But Brian Curtis, great to hear your voice again, editor at large at The Ringer. Thanks for talking to us about this.
Thank you, Colin.
All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to look at this a different way. We're going to go from sports to theater. And we're going to, well, assuming there's any difference, but the kind that's on stages anyway. Welcome back. This, we call this show The Scramble because we like to scramble around on Mondays and react to things that happen over the weekend. And there were pieces written over the weekend, published over the weekend anyway, that excited a lot of controversy or at least conversation or got people thinking and talking. Brian Curtis, who was just on, I think his piece was one of those pieces. But one of the ones I saw circulated a lot was by Kevin Williamson, a roving correspondent for the National Review. He's joining us right now. His piece uses a different prism to look at some of the same things that we just talked about. You know, it is the prism of a certain kind of alpha male depicted in movies and theater. Kevin Williamson, welcome to our show.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm just fine. Thanks for asking. So the thing that you begin your piece with or the way that you introduce us to a certain idea is through Glengarry Glen Ross, the play by David Mamet,
yeah.
But really more specifically, the movie version, where there's a character named Blake, played by Alec Baldwin. We're just going to hear him just to get things going. The first voice you're going to hear is the voice of the downtrodden character, Shelley Levine, a salesman on the downward slope of things. He's going to complain that the leads are the things that salesmen use to try to get new clients. The leads are weak. And then you'll hear Blake's response.
The leads are weak.
The leads are weak. Leads are weak, you're weak. I've been in this business 15 years.
What's your name?
You, that's my name. You know why, mister? Because you drove a Hyundai to get here tonight. I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name. And your name is your wanting. And you can't play in the man's game. You can't close them. Then go home and tell your wife your troubles. Because only one thing counts in this life. Get them to sign on the line which is dotted.
All right, that's the character Blake. So, Kevin, what does he mean to us in this particular situation? What does he symbolize?
Yeah, good stuff there. I think it depends on how you look at the play. I think the way the play is intended to be understood is this dark and friendless and largely amoral universe of which Blake is a part. Now, he doesn't appear in the play. He was a character written specifically for the movie when the play was rewritten as a movie a few years later. And one of the ironies about that is the investors didn't think that the play was saleable enough. And so they put this great speech in about salesmanship. But what's weird, I guess it's maybe not so weird, is that certain people, certain men especially, I guess, and particularly young men, have embraced Blake as something to aspire to. They memorized this speech. They quote it back and forth to each other. I was at a revival of the show on Broadway a few years ago in 2012, and there were some young guys, you know, waiting to see the play who were kind of quoting this thing back and forth to them. And I was thinking they must have been really disappointed because that character doesn't actually appear in the play, just being someone for the movie. So I was thinking about that crazy interview that Anthony Scaramucci gave to the New Yorker and thinking to myself, you know, normal adult human beings don't really talk like that. But people who are imitating certain characters they've come across in movies, television, things like that do. And I think that Blake and the general David Mamet universe is one of those things that's often imitated in that way.
Right. There's a scene. Well, we decided not to run the clip because it just doesn't really work very well as pure audio. But there's a scene from the movie Boiler Room, very similar kind of thing, where the guys, these are young guys who are trying to be traders, are sitting around in somebody's house watching the movie Wall Street with Charlie Sheen and Michael Douglas as Gordon Gekko. And they know it's in the way that you're talking about right now with Blake. They know the dialogue, Vin Diesel and all these.
Good.
Yeah. And they're just saying it right along with the thing. there. And once again, I think we understand Wall Street and to a certain degree Glengarry Glen Ross as cautionary tales about a certain kind of emptiness, but they're not always embraced that way.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. And I think that, and of course, this all relates to Trump, which is what the column is really about. Certain people look at Donald Trump and they see him as being this character that they aspire to be, this commanding, you know, so-called alpha male. I think that terminology is faintly ridiculous in the context of modern human beings. But of course, the thing about Trump is that he isn't that guy. He plays that guy on television. He's a lot like the people who look up to him, that he has been spent his life doing an imitation of something that he actually isn't. I mean, he's not a great salesman. He can't even get Republicans to agree on the health care deal that they all want to agree on. You think he could sell real estate? Not if it was a terrible real estate like they're having to sell in Glengarry Glen Ross. The funny thing about Trump, of course, is that he's been a pretty middling businessman. Mm. He was really bad at operating casinos and hotels. His real estate career, fairly middling. Most people who've looked at it figure he probably would have made more money if he just parked his inheritance in a mutual fund and spent the next 20 years just amusing himself. What he's been really good at is the celebrity business, which if you look at his own financial filings, that's where his money comes from. He's got something like $300 million in cash and securities and then a brand that he values at $10 billion, which I think is probably absurd. But even if we take that at face value, Trump's career hasn't been Gordon Gekko's career. It's been Paris Hilton's career.
Right. Well, and so I don't know if you heard us in the previous segment. We played the Scaramucci clip where he talks about Trump sinking baskets and putts and all kinds of stuff like that. And in a way that you point out, and you also cite Peggy Noonan for pointing it out, there's a way in which he's not a tough guy. He presents as a tough guy, and I think he gets identified by a certain part of his base as a tough guy. There's a way in which there's something a little soft about him. There's a, you know, for the most part, he likes to be at his own resorts. You know, during the campaign, it seemed like he would try to get back to Trump Tower or to Mar-a-Lago at the end of a day rather than sleep in a bed that he didn't know. There's a way in which this guy is the opposite of the tough guy he presents as.
Well, yeah, think about it. He's a, you know, second, third generation rich guy. You know, he's a spoiled, coddled suburban kid who had a very wealthy and well-connected father. And something that he's had trouble living up to, I think, in some ways, you know, was really Fred Trump, his dad, who really built the Trump empire that that Trump inherited. And what Trump did, of course, was build the media end of that, the product licensing and all the rest of it, which is all good. That's a fine, respectable business. Don't get me wrong on that. Well, maybe not a respectable business, but a fine business. Don't get me wrong. But you know, he's someone who's never lifted anything heavier than money. Who inherited something like $200 million worth of real estate from his father, who had all of that financing and stuff in place. Whose earliest projects were backed by his dad and all that kind of stuff. So he likes to come out and present himself as this self-made man and this tough guy. But he's actually a guy who sits at home whining on Twitter that Joe Scarborough's not nice to him on NBC anymore or MSNBC anymore. And his tweets and such and his petulance and his complaints about, oh, everyone's so unfair to me, the media's so unfair, it's kind of sad. But on the other hand, he's this guy who's presented himself as the great deal maker, the leader, the executive who can get things done, who has shown that he can't do anything. He's gotten almost nothing done since being the president. So we've got a lot of stuff that's important on the national agenda. We've got tax reform. We've got health care. We've got another bunch of things that need to happen. He's got a Republican majority in both houses and a whole party lined up ready to sign off on getting something done on these things. But this requires executive leadership, and Trump is just not a guy who can do that. And in fact, he's never really managed a large, complex corporate enterprise.
There are ways in which he, first of all, I have to say that we almost didn't have you on the show today because you linked to a Rush song in your piece. I'm trying to get the rock band Rush off this show as much as possible. But there's, but we forgive you. But
it's on the radio, it's in my head.
Right. And they're Canadian anyway. But there's an Elvis Costello song that mentions fingers that have never known working blisters. To me, there's that in Trump. There was a moment during the campaign, I had this aperçu, or I was looking at him, I was thinking, well, he's got this sort of whatever that's going on that creates that particular skin tone. And then the poofed up hair in some kind of way. And then the fondness for gold and chandeliers and candelabras. And I thought...
He looks like he lives in Liberace's house.
It's exactly where I was going. That is exactly where I was going. In some ways, the celebrity he most presents as is Liberace, which would be, of course, a very appalling statement from his point of view.
Well, the thing is, Liberace was a conservative. You know, he was a pretty hardcore anti-communist Republican. Trump's not much of one. You actually wrote an essay about that early in the campaign, Trump and Liberace as being sort of the same character. In talking about this stuff in movies, there's another Al Pacino movie called The Devil's Advocate, which is a silly movie, but kind of a good one in some ways. And there's a character who is this homicidal real estate developer. And the people who did the movie actually, however they managed it, bamboozled Trump into letting them shoot these scenes in his ridiculous apartment with the fake Michelangelo frescoes on the ceiling and the gold-leafed everything. And it's absurd and hilarious, but... Trump is one of those guys who really has internalized the lesson, I think, that for a certain kind of person, there's no such thing as bad publicity. When you think about it, if not for an embarrassing tabloid divorce case back in the 80s, Trump would be just a fairly obscure New York City real estate developer.
So we're talking to Kevin Williamson. He wrote this piece for the National Review. We're heading into our final segment of the show that's going to be about chiefs of staff. Chris Whipple's written a book about chiefs of staff. And it seems to me that one of the things that chiefs of staff do and presidents do is try to figure out what the balance is between work and any kind of relaxation for the president. It's a really hard job for most people. They find ways of releasing it, whether it's Barack Obama with this ascetic seven almond evening where he's maybe watching a little bit of basketball and eating these almonds really slowly, or George W. Bush had that whole mountain biking thing where he would just get this whole reckless streak out. But I mean, it's a hard job. For the most part, it's a really hard job, or you just have to decide you're going to outsource it to some chief of staff who's going to have a really hard job. But one of the things that I think, one of the ways your piece kind of bleeds over into that conversation is, I don't think anybody has really decided yet how hard this job is in the Trump administration. He seems to be watching like a lot of television, and maybe he's never really worked
on fans because he's not doing very much.
Well, that's what I'm sort of saying. Maybe he's never worked really, really hard.
No, I don't think he probably has. I mean, that's an interesting question of who's going to end up actually doing the job of the presidency for the next 3.5 years or so. Trump has surrounded himself with some really good people in his cabinet and some really dodgy people among his close advisors and kind of personal confidants. So if a Trump administration ends up being essentially run by the Rick Perrys and Betsy DeVosses and people like that, then I'm perfectly happy with that. That's a best case outcome, I suppose. But I'm not sure that cabinet officials and such can really exercise that kind of leadership when you've got a president who's just intellectually and morally and personally unfit and unable to do the job.
Typically the person who can be the corrective is the chief of staff. So this is perhaps a good place for us to say farewell to Kevin Williamson. Great piece, a great conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And then we're going to take a little break here, a very short break. We're going to come back and talk chiefs of staff with Chris Whipple, who has, as they say, written the book.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf, with help from our intern, Tim Cohn. Amanda Fish is now called Wanda. The part of Leo McGarry was played by Bill Curry. On tomorrow's show, the joy of independent minor league baseball, where misfits meet major league stars of the downward slope and guys who just can't quit the game. And now, back to Colin.
If you're wondering why we're using that music, that's like the Fox election headquarters music or something. We've been making fun of the way in which a lot of news and public affairs programming sounds more and more like sports programming, whether it's the invasion of Iraq in 2003 or just election night or whatever. The other reason we're doing it is I guess it's not really fair to say we lost the Get Smart music that we usually use, but we're having trouble getting to it anyway. We're having technical difficulties. Anyway, that's a long explanation about something you don't even care about. But you do care about chiefs of staff, everybody suddenly is very interested in chiefs of staff. As I said before, I cover politics. I've been writing about politics and national affairs for decades and decades now. I know that Barack Obama had four chiefs of staff. I couldn't tell you the names of two of them. That's not really true anymore. I looked them up. But going into today, I could have told you, I could have told you two of them, Rahm Emanuel and Bill Daley. I had no idea the other two. But now, right now, everybody's really, really interested in chiefs of staff because one of them has just been driven out. Another one is coming in. Everywhere you go, there's conversations about whether General Kelly can do the job. So the person who might be best equipped to have an answer to that is Chris Whipple, the author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. I should say that Chris Whipple will appear at the Hotchkiss Library of Sharon, Connecticut this Friday, August 4th, 6 p.m. Contact the library. It's the Hotchkiss Library of Sharon, Connecticut, which makes me think it's not the actual Hotchkiss School Library, because that's in Lakeville. So call the Hotchkiss Library in Sharon for tickets, which you'll want to get after you hear this interview. Hi, Chris. Chris Whipple, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
By the way, I can give you another public appearance tip. I was doing a public appearance down in New Haven with Al Franken yesterday, and it was sponsored by the R.J. Julia, which is the great independent bookstore. And Roxanne Cody, who runs that store, was asking all kinds of questions backstage of me and Al Franken, mainly of Al Franken, about Kelly and whether he'd be a good chief of staff. And I said, well, there's a book out about chiefs of staff. And she said, really? And she got very excited. So call R.J. Julia right now. I'm sure you can get
some of
this.
I will. So, that's the tip.
So let's talk about this job. First of all, we should say, as much as the government of the United States attempts to diversify itself, this is a job that's only ever been done, as far as I know, by white men, right? How long has it been around?
That's certainly true.
Yeah. How long has there been a chief of staff?
Well, you know, some people would say that Eisenhower began the job with Sherman Adams. He was sort of the civilian version of Ike's Army Chief of Staff. But I really think that the empowered White House chief, as we now know him, and they've all been men, as you point out, really began with, ironically, with H.R. Haldeman, who, of course, was Nixon's infamous White House chief, the Lord High Executioner, who so-called, who was devoured by Watergate. The irony is that Haldeman really wrote the book. He created the template for how the job should be run, of course, with the exception of Watergate. That's where he failed to speak truth to power. But he really created the position, and the model is one that presidents have strayed from at their peril ever since. Every president learns, with the exception of our current president so far, that you cannot govern effectively without empowering a White House chief of staff as first among equals to execute your agenda and, most important, tell you what you don't want to hear. That's the key.
Right. So I want to go through a lot about that. I do want to just do a little historical geeky footnote, which is, of course, the through line from Haldeman to Sherman Adams, is that Nixon claimed that he was the one who had to fire Sherman Adams. Sherman Adams had to be let go for accepting, among other things, a vicuña coat.
That's right.
But however, in reality, like many things that Richard Nixon said, that wasn't true. Meade Alcorn, who was a Connecticut Republican legend, was the person who actually had to fire Sherman Adams, who then started a ski lodge, which is good. He had a vicuña coat to stay warm.
He was a former New Hampshire governor.
Right.
And so was John Sununu, and thereby proving James Baker's rule, which is that former governors, former principals, former CEOs don't usually succeed as White House chiefs.
Right. Do you think it's fair to say that the chiefs of staff that we remember, like when I started thinking about this whole topic, I thought about Sununu right away. I thought about Don Regan, who was Reagan's chief of staff for a while. I thought about chiefs of staff. Yeah, Haldeman is another great example. The people that we know, I mean, if you're doing a really good job as chief of staff, there's a better chance people don't know who you are.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, the phrase used to be that the first requirement was a passion for anonymity. That's no longer really true in the modern era because, you know, the chief, among other things, has to occasionally go on the Sunday talk shows and put a face to the position, which is, without a doubt, in my mind, the second most powerful job in government. Dick Cheney likes to say that the White House chief has more power than the vice president. He doesn't always add that that's true except when Dick Cheney was the vice president.
But see, Dick Cheney belongs to this kind of Shaolin warrior monk class of Republican chiefs of staff. He had been a chief of staff. Rumsfeld had been a chief of staff. Jim Baker was chief of staff for two different presidencies. These are guys who really know how to do this. And Jim Baker, I think, famously said that if you want to be chief of staff, you should be paying a lot more attention to the words of staff than you are to the word chief. And I think that's significant for Trump, that, you know, he didn't really pick that kind of person. He picked Reince Priebus, who's kind of a second-tier guy who'd only really worked at the Republican National Committee, right? And a lawyer from Kenosha, Wisconsin. He didn't pick one of those kind of elite guys that you can get as a Republican.
Well, that's certainly true, and Priebus made plenty of rookie mistakes. But, you know, at the end of the day, Trump, you know, the irony of listening to Trump this morning talking about Kelly as somebody who will go down as the greatest White House chief ever. Look, the first 6 months proved that Donald Trump has no idea what the job is about because he failed to empower Reince Priebus to do the job. The White House chief has got to be, first of all, the gatekeeper who gives the president time and space to think. He's got to be the person who, through whom everybody goes to the president, with the exception, let's say, of family. You know, I mean, okay, Ivanka and Jared are not going to do that, but the staff has to do that. And, you know, Scaramucci, this guy, in the first place, shouldn't be within 100 miles of a functioning White House. The first thing Kelly should do is yank his credentials and get him off the grounds. Failing that, Scaramucci has to report through Kelly, just as everybody else in the West Wing should, or this cannot work. Look, it's possible that Bannon can come and go from the Oval and pretend to be in charge of policy, kind of the way Ed Meese did in the Reagan White House. But in that White House, Baker controlled everything that mattered, executing the agenda. And Kelly has to do that for Trump to have any chance whatsoever of governing.
There are so many places I want to go with this conversation, but one of the questions that I have, the only other general that I can think of was Al Haig. There may have been some others that I'm not aware of. And you and I, we've not been generals. We don't know what that's like. But I'm thinking that it's a slightly different job, that in many respects, what a chief of staff has to do is recognize a multiplicity of cross currents of power, influence, desire for access. I mean, in some ways, there's almost the opposite of a clear chain of command. There's a whole bunch of people who want to get to the president, want access to that person's time, and you kind of have to figure out, maybe even on a day-by-day basis, how to navigate that.
Yeah, it's exponentially more difficult than being a general, as difficult as that job may be. And Kelly, by all accounts, is a very effective leader and extremely competent. But this is another level. Baker and Leon Panetta, in my mind, were the gold standard, the two best. And Panetta is a guy who had been around the block. He'd been a congressman. He'd been, for many terms, he'd been an OMB director. He knew budgets. He knew everything. He knew policy. He knew Capitol Hill. He was described, and I describe him in the book as a guy who had an iron fist inside a velvet glove. You have to be, it's an amazing skill set. I mean, you have to be the ultimate diplomat. You have to know, you have to return phone calls to Capitol Hill all hours of the day and night. And at the end of the day, in addition to all of that, you've got to be the guy, as Panetta and Baker were, who can walk into the Oval Office, close the door, and tell the president what he doesn't want to hear. Rumsfeld, you know, in the book, Rumsfeld tells me a number of stories about doing that with Jerry Ford. And he said, look, the White House chief is the one person besides his wife who can look him straight in the eye and tell him, you cannot go down this road. Here are the reasons why. Trust me, it's not going to work. Priebus was utterly unable to do that. And this is a West Wing populated by a lot of enablers and sycophants. It's pretty clear that there are no red lines that they won't allow the president to cross. And I think Kelly well, we can get into this, but, you know, he really needs to have conditions with Trump, and frankly, he needs to be ready to resign if Trump crosses certain lines.
Right. I mean, first of all, just back up for a second. I want to come back to that before we run out of time. But, you know, it's not unusual for presidents to make a bad first choice. Panetta replaced Mac McClarty, who's a really, really nice guy, probably too nice a guy. Didn't have the iron fist, just had the velvet glove. Sununu and Don Regan were probably maybe a little bit of the opposite. I think Regan actually famously hung up on Nancy Reagan one time, which you just don't do. So, I mean, it's not – and Jerry Ford and Jimmy Carter, as you point out in the book, they made the ultimate wrong decision, which was thinking that they could get along without a chief of staff.
You know, no question about it. Look, presidents sometimes, you know, one former chief told me that it's a little bit like alcoholism. Presidents have to hit rock bottom before they're ready to admit that they can't run the White House by themselves, and they have to empower a White House chief to make things happen. You got to wonder if Donald Trump would recognize rock bottom if he hit it. I mean, this White House is the most dysfunctional in history. There's just no comparison to, you know, Jimmy Carter. It took him 2.5 years to realize that he had to appoint a chief, Ham Jordan. Jordan didn't have the title or the power until then. Same thing, Bill Clinton. It took him 1.5 years to realize that he needed somebody like Panetta and he needed to empower him. But there's no comparison because this is – the Trump White House is completely broken, maybe beyond repair. It can't do anything right. It can't issue executive orders that are enforceable. It can't pass legislation. It can't prioritize the president's agenda. It can't get anybody on the same page. It's thoroughly broken. So this is a tough, tough task.
Very good chocolate cake, though. I think you're emphasizing too much of the negative, Chris Whipple. So, you know, you and I were not in
It's a piece of the most beautiful chocolate cake you've ever seen,
exactly.
Actually.
Exactly, okay.
The job.
Let's get the quote right, yeah. So, you and I weren't in the room, but I think we both absolutely know that General Kelly said, I have some preconditions. I am not taking this job unless you vouchsafe to me items A, B, and C. First of all, would you want to hazard a guess what any of those items are?
Well, the first item ought to be that he's first among equals and that everybody, including Scaramucci, again, with the possible exception of Bannon, has to go through him. That would be condition number one. In addition to that condition, I think that Kelly should be, you know, the job is not really about loyalty to the president. The job is about loyalty to the presidency and to the Constitution. This White House has been, you know, I mean, he's got to be able to go into Donald Trump, close the door and say, look, there are certain lines you may not cross or I will resign. Every chief who's really been successful has been ready to resign. And I think he should tell Trump, for example, that if he tweets something that is demonstrably false, I'm gone. You can find White House Chief number 3.
That might make for a very short tenure, so we'll have to see how that plays out.
But every chief has to be ready to resign, or they can't be effective.
All right, so this is fascinating stuff, and Chris Whipple has written The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. I would suggest that General Kelly and Donald Trump, since Donald Trump likes to watch television a lot, they should first of all get Chris Whipple's book, and then they should also sit down and watch The West Wing and just see what Leo McGarry does. He was a great chief of staff. He respected both the presidency and ferociously was loyal to his president. So,
I would add that Kelly really should pick up the phone to Jim Baker if he hasn't already, and he should pick up the phone to Ken Duberstein, who was Reagan's last White House chief. It's troubling to me that, I mean, what I'm hearing is that these chiefs have not been getting phone calls. He needs to do that.
Absolutely.
If he's serious about governing.
There are plenty of people out here who've done that job and done it well. Good idea to talk to them. Good idea to talk to Chris Whipple, too. Thanks to Jonathan McNichol, Tim Cohn, and Kion Wolf for getting this show on the air. We've got a great show about indie baseball tomorrow. No charge at the door. I guess they like my taste. Look like I run this place. Look like I run, look like I run, look like I run this place.
Trump has fired somebody seems like once a week since Inauguration Day. It's almost as if he only has experience on a reality show where he fires somebody once a week.